Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin here in the second hour. Boy, I better be on my toes. Couldn't even get my name out there. It's pretty bad when you can't get your last name out. I only had a couple days off. In fact, it was just one real day off yesterday. Actually went out to Powder Valley yesterday. Have you ever been out to Powder Valley? You got to go. Take the kids out there. It's a great place to take little children because I just saw all sorts of little children out there. What we did was there's a hiking trail. So it's like a 1.5 mile hiking trail through the woods. You know what we saw? We saw two fawns. Now, I've seen plenty of deer, and usually if I've seen them, I've tried to shoot them. But I didn't have my gun. It's not deer season, and I'm with the kids. I don't think my daughter would have taken too kindly to me shooting a deer. Two fawns coming through the woods, no mother, just walking through the woods with their little spotted backs, and they were drinking out of a stream. It was like, I mean, it was a Labor Day miracle is what it was. It was amazing. But my knees are killing me. They're absolutely killing me because I was walking downhill on these steep trails. And for some reason, that just hurts my knees and left me in a mental state last night where I probably, if you would have asked me what my last name was, I probably wouldn't have been able to give you a clear answer. See how much I've recovered since last night. Things are improving. They really are, even after Labor Day. Dr. Jeffrey Kloh is our guest here for the second hour. He joins us here in Studio A. So much has been made lately about the lost Gospels, about these documents that supposedly, if we were really fair, belong in the New Testament, or maybe they even should displace the Gospels that we've come to know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We're going to be talking about the lost Gospels. What are they? Are they Gospels? Were they ever really lost? Are they worth finding again? If so, for what reason? Dr. Jeffrey Kloh is Assistant Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. He's going to be leading a lay Bible Institute in October titled, Which Jesus? How Many Gospels Are There? Jeffrey, welcome back.
Thank you.
I refer to you as doctor, but I understand you are on the very edge of making that official at the University of Leeds in England.
Correct. Yeah, I have to go through my oral exams in a couple of weeks here, and I should be all set.
Well, this will help our listeners understand why you're here sitting with us in the studio to answer these questions. What has been the main subject of your study in the course of your doctorate?
Yeah, it's actually sort of interesting because when I was a graduate student here in St. Louis and then went on to Leeds, nobody really cared about manuscripts. It was just sort of esoteric and, old things that we thought we were done with. And then about 3 years ago, with all these Da Vinci Code types of things going on, all of a sudden it becomes significant. And one real helpful aspect of my work in Leeds has been that my supervisor there is Keith Elliott, who edited the standard scholarly edition of these second, third, fourth century texts.
The very things we're going to be talking
exactly,
about.
Exactly, right.
Okay, yeah. If I were to ask him, are these candidates? He's the expert.
He's the expert.
Are these candidates for the New Testament canon? Do they belong in there, or how would you categorize them? What did he say?
Well, Professor Elliott would tell you, in fact, the title of his book is The Apocryphal New Testament, which would indicate that it's not part of the canonical New Testament. Now, Professor Elliott really would probably fall to one side. Other scholars that you hear about today on TV, for example, like Bart Ehrman or a Karen King, would really argue that they should be part of the New Testament and flesh out our picture of Jesus.
Okay, so give us some names of these documents, these apocryphal writings from the first, second, third century.
Okay. Yeah, it's hard. There's several categories of these, I suppose. As far as apocryphal gospels, what is usually meant are gospels that come from within a generally Orthodox Christian perspective. There you would have something like the Infancy Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Peter. The Infancy Gospel of Thomas is really sort of what we thought or what somebody thought Jesus would have done as a child. You know, so what would it be like to have the Son of God as a two-year-old playing in the sand sort of a thing.
Some pious speculations.
Pious speculations, right. Okay. The Gospel of Peter, similar, kind of fleshing out, making more dramatic Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection. Those don't make the news because they're generally Orthodox. You know, they assume that Jesus is divine, for example, and that Jesus rose from the dead. What makes the news are these so-called lost Gospels, like the recent Gospel of Judas, the Gospel of Philip, Gospel of Mary, Gospel of Thomas, These are the ones that really get the news because they do present a very different picture of Jesus.
Are they in a different category than those pious speculations where, you know, there's a little account of Jesus when he's two and he creates a clay bird and it flies away, something
right,
like
yeah.
that. Are they in a different category?
Well, if by different category you mean they present a really different understanding of Jesus, yes, certainly.
Is that the ultimate test here for us to answer the question, how many Gospels are there or how many Gospels should there be? Is what Jesus, what kind of a Jesus do they present?
Well, that's really where the debate is today. See, some scholars will argue that if we exclude or don't read these other Gospels, our view of Jesus will be impoverished, and our Christianity may be better, because they don't like the term Christian, really, maybe better our spirituality will be inhibited. On the other hand, you do get a very different picture of Jesus. So, you know, there's both the theological question of what Jesus is portrayed. There's also the historical question of how did these Gospels come about, what communities, what groups of people wrote them and used them, and were they ever used by the same people who were using Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John?
Okay, let's deal with that first, and that is, what were the communities that produced, say, the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Mary or the Gospel of Philip, whatever they may be? What communities did produce those, and were they Christian communities?
Well, let's put aside Thomas for a minute because that's very complex. If we have time, we'll talk about Thomas later. It's also the probably earliest of these so-called lost Gospels. Let me start with Gospel of Judas, since everyone's heard of that. The Gospel of Judas was written somewhere between 150 and 170, as far as we can tell. And the way it came out in the media this spring was, you know, here's this different story of Judas, a different way to portray Jesus' death and resurrection. What they didn't talk about in that gospel was that what is presented is, in fact, a completely different cosmology, a different view of the world. Not God created the world fell into sin, and God sent Jesus to restore the world, but the world was created by these emanations of divine beings from this non-personal spiritual being, and the further away these emanations got, these divine beings got from this source, the more corrupt they became. The last of these then created the earth, almost as a joke, and the earth and all physical matter is therefore evil and to be shied away from. And so where Judas comes in is he is the one who frees Jesus from his physical body so that he can be spiritual again. So it's got a completely different perspective on the world than you'll find in, well, the Old Testament or the canonical gospel.
Okay, so the names are the same, Jesus, Judas.
Names are the same, Jesus,
right. The general surface events seem to be the same.
Right.
Jesus dies and, quote-unquote, rises again.
Right.
But the entire context of it is entirely different in the
Gospel.
Right,
it assumes a completely different story to make it work.
So Jesus is conspiring with Judas to free himself of his material existence so that he can return to a purely spiritual state and therefore be closer to that transcendent and unknowable God at the center of all.
And of course help others along the way to that same journey.
Okay,
right.
Well, let's talk about Judas a little bit more here then. Was it ever really, going to the second part of your question, was it ever really a serious contender when it came along in, say, 150 A.D.?
Right.
Was it ever a serious contender in the church's eyes for inclusion in,
well,
in the Gospels?
Well, here's sort of the ironic thing. Irenaeus knows about it, and he mentions it in literally one sentence. Irenaeus is a church father in Lyon, France. He writes a book against the heresies in about 180, and he mentions the Gospel of Judas and really just sort of dismisses it. Some people read this. It's also sort of interesting that it appears that not even the Gnostics paid a whole lot of attention to the Gospel of Judas. After all, it's not mentioned elsewhere. It was not used by later Gnostic writers. It's not referenced. And there's different strains of Gnosticism. This Gospel of Judas reflects Sethian Gnosticism. Seth is the third child of Adam and Eve, and some Gnostics viewed Seth as the kind of restoration after the whole mess of Cain and Abel. And so Seth is called the Christ in the Gospel of Judas. So it's coming from a whole different perspective. And by 150, now we talked about this a few months ago, by 150, the four Gospels were already being copied in a single manuscript, being quoted and used by the church, and the Gospel of Judas is being copied in manuscripts with other Gnostic texts. It's just not being used by the same groups of people.
Okay, so one of the ways that we are able to tell what Christians were reading and accepting and recognizing as, we would say, canonical, belonging in the corpus of Scripture, is that they circulated these writings literally bound together, Matthew, Mark, right. Luke, and John, and that they used them in their corporate worship and in other study and things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
So Judas never appeared in the books, so to speak.
Never appeared in the books and never appeared in the church fathers, who are the theologians, the pastors who are writing for the church.
All right. What about the other big one that we've heard so much? The hubbaloo on this one was a little earlier than the Gospel of Judas, but the Gospel of Thomas. You said
right.
That was a more complicated question.
Thomas is more complicated because there's some question about its origins. Some elements, well, let me explain first. The Gospel of Thomas has no story to it. It is simply Thomas saying or reporting to the other disciples things that Jesus told him. There is no story. Jesus does not heal anyone. He doesn't tell any parables. There's no journeys anywhere, no birth, no death and resurrection. It's simply 114 sayings of Jesus in literally random order. There is no structure of any sort, topically, thematically, keywords, nothing.
It's like the Book of Proverbs, kind of.
Book of Proverbs,
yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
And But what's complicated is some of these sayings are almost identical to what you find in the Synoptic Gospels. Golden Rule, for example, things like this. Some of the parables are almost verbatim what you find in the Synoptic Gospels. On the other hand, there's some material which is not from the canonical Gospels and does reflect, if not Gnosticism in its kind of full-grown form, at least Gnostic thinking. For example, a denigration of creation, a downplaying of the physical body, a downplaying of male-female distinctions, for example. So some of those elements clearly do not come from the canonical Gospels. So what we have in the current form of the Gospel of Thomas is generally dated to at least 150, 175, if not a little bit later. But some elements might go earlier. And, in fact, we have a few papyrus fragments from 2nd, 3rd century, well, 3rd, 4th century, which seem to be part of this earlier stream.
Okay, so it's a mixed bag.
It's a mixed bag.
The Gospel of Thomas right. May be reflecting Christianity under a Gnostic influence, but not
right.
full-blown Gnosticism.
Not full-blown
different
Gnosticism.
Worldview, different cosmology.
Right.
Elaine Pagels was the one who, at least in publishing, popularized
right.
the Gospel of Thomas later.
Right.
We interviewed her. Did we interview her? I can't remember if we did or not. We did hear some audio from her at one point in talking about the Gospel of Thomas on a different program,
right.
where she says, look, this is how you got to understand the Gospel of Thomas. It came first, and
right.
then the Gospel of John was right. written to kind of counterbalance it and refute it.
Right.
Is there any merit to this relationship that she proposes between the Gospel of Thomas and the canonical Gospel
well,
of John?
Well, I'll put it this way. No other scholar of Gnosticism or the Gospels has argued the same thing. What her thesis requires is that you have a full-blown Gospel of Thomas prior to the year 90, and there's simply no credible evidence for that happening. She bases that argument, it's in her book Beyond Belief, she bases this argument on it's really rather slim, in fact, on the three references to Thomas in the Gospel of John, where she argues that Thomas is made to look like an idiot. Now, I'm not sure you can quite make that case, but that's one claim. But then also, specifically in the introduction to the Gospel, the first 18 verses, where the divinity of Jesus is so highly emphasized. And she argues that you don't have any of that in the Gospel of Thomas. Of course, the problem is you don't have much of anything in the Gospel of Thomas regarding the person and work of Jesus. All you have are his sayings. So it's a pretty, to my mind anyway, it's a pretty difficult argument to make. There's simply no evidence. And as I said, there are no, I mean, you read the standard non-commodity library texts and things like this. No one makes an argument that Thomas would precede John or that John is a reaction to Thomas.
I guess it should be pointed out at this point that pseudepigraphal writings, that is, writings written under false names,
right,
or attributed to people who did not actually write them, apocryphal writings, which are kind of spin-offs or fanciful,
right,
speculations about things, those aren't unique to the New Testament period. The Old Testament has
some
of this stuff too, doesn't
right
it?
Well, at least of course, we don't have much material from prior to the Second Temple period in Judaism, but from the period right before the time of Jesus, yeah, there's
this intertestamental writing that is just
certainly
stories about Noah,
right,
and you name it.
Yeah,
you
there's apocalypses of Abraham, apocalypses of Adam, all sorts of things.
What was this kind of a cottage industry from, say, 2nd century B.C. through 2nd century A.D. of spinning off religious texts that had some kind of connection to the accepted holy writings of Judaism and then later Christianity?
I would say it didn't really end at the end of the second century. It continued. There's, for example, apocryphal Acts for all the apostles. Everybody gets a book of Acts where they do amazing things. You know, I think every town wanted to have their own apostle, so they wrote a book to match. You know, sort of a thing. So it wasn't unique to Judaism or Christianity. Sort of the genre of hero writing in Greco-Roman literature is very common, where you have a character as sort of a hero who you emulate and model your life after. Not what you find in the Gospels, but that's sort of a common type of literature. Jewish apocalyptic is a whole other issue. The Book of Revelation is a classic example of Jewish apocalyptic. Even a little tag at the end of do not change anything in this book. That's a standard formula in Jewish apocalyptic texts. This revelation from where the skies are opened and things are seen which are not happening on earth. That's just the way Jewish apocalyptic works. And the Book of Revelation is not unique within that context.
So as a genre of literature, it's standard
boilerplate
kind of stuff.
Right.
Of course, that does not wouldn't elevate the other writings to its level or diminish the Book of Revelation.
Well, that depends on your perspective, I suppose. I mean, yeah, certainly, it's we talked a little bit about Revelation. A Greek Orthodox church, for example, does not read the Book of Revelation in worship, and it was very seriously questioned in the early centuries. It was almost, I hesitate to say it this way, but in the third century, it appears to have been sort of a left behind for Christians, a popular. The manuscripts, for example, that contain Revelation, it's always copied by itself. It's never with any other New Testament books prior to the fourth century. And the manuscripts that contain it are very poorly written. The lines kind of slope down the page. The pen ink gets lighter and darker as the scribe dips his ink. They appear to be sort of personal copies and probably read for pious usage, never for liturgical usage.
So that kind of leads to the next question, leaving behind that kind of big question mark about the Book of Revelation. In these first centuries of Christendom, we have writings that are circulating, often not by themselves, but bound together, Paul's epistles and
the four Gospels
mm-hmm. circulating together for use in worship and for scholarly study, I assume. So when into this flow of documents, there appears these Gnostic writings, Gospel mm-hmm. of Thomas, Gospel of Judas, and the others that we just mentioned briefly. What does the church do with them?
Well, you got to say, I mean, given, again, and this is sort of the winners writing the history, but this is all we have, the church does not use them. You do not see fathers of the third century like Origen or Cyprian. In the fourth century, Eusebius or Didymus, people like this. They're simply not using these Gospels. They were written by different groups of people with a completely different perspective. They did not accept the Old Testament, for example. The creation of the world by a God who loves the world is simply not in the story. And these Gospels, rather clearly, were written for communities that were distinct from what we would recognize today as Orthodox Christianity.
So would it be akin to the simple fact that Orthodox Christians today have no use for the Book of Mormon? It purports to be in the same line of writing as the New Testament, another testament of Jesus Christ, and yet no Christian with his salt would contemplate reading it and studying it or except to refute Mormonism.
Right. Actually, that's a very good analogy, because what happened, it seems, is Jesus, well, and this happened, as you said, with other Old Testament characters, Jesus becomes sort of a character to be used, and a whole different storylines are developed around this character. Maybe at some point, I don't want to get to it at this point, but how we went from gospel proclamation to gospel genre is maybe a part of this issue as well. That the Book of Mormon sort of looks like, say, Pentateuch, you know, this kind of history sort of a thing, but it's something different. You know, it just has a different feel to it.
We're talking with Pastor Jeffrey Kloa. He is Assistant Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. He's going to be leading a lay Bible Institute in October titled, Which Jesus? How Many Gospels Are There? We're talking about the Lost Gospels. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We have an in-studio email address. It's issuesetc@kfuo.org. We're coming up on a break, and this break is a great time to call with questions or comments on these controversial and some say lost gospels. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Let's take up the subject you just introduced, and that is, as a process or as history, how do we get from the gospel being preached from the mouth of the apostles throughout the world to the gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, as documents that then circulate to kind of take the apostles' place in the course
right.
of that preaching.
Right. Yeah, actually, you can see it reflected in the titles themselves. I mean, like, for example, Paul's letter to the Galatians. He, you know, in the beginning there, he's talking about this alternative proclamation, this alternative gospel. And he says, if anybody preaches to you a different gospel from what I preach to you, let him be anathema. Right. So gospel there clearly means the proclaimed message about Jesus. The beginning of the Gospel of Mark says, you know, to Evangelio, Gospel of Jesus Christ. I should have brought my text, I suppose. Jim could quote it off the top of his head. In any case, Evangelion means proclamation. So proclamation about Jesus Christ.
So the beginning of the,
beginning
proclamation,
of the proclamation
of Jesus Christ.
Well, about Jesus Christ, mm-hmm. probably. And that's how it's used in the titles of the four Gospels. Now, you got to remember, the Gospels themselves, our four Gospels, have no titles nor any attribution of authorship in the texts themselves. They are uniformly titled to the Evangelion Kata Matthaion, Evangelion Kata Markon. So that means the good news according to Matthew. So clearly the according to means a message. All right. Now once you've got these collected together and used as documents, as you say, once the apostles are gone, and you have these four writings called Evangelion, now that the title or the word Evangelion sort of takes on a different meaning, and that is almost a genre. So when you get to the Gospel of Judas, rather interestingly, it's not called the Evangelion Kata Judaion. It's the Evangelion Judaios, genitive. So it's the Gospel by Judas, or the Gospel probably about Judas.
Hmm.
So the word Evangelion itself, gospel, has changed meaning over those 100 years.
So we have a kind of this 100-year period where we're talking, initially the gospel is being preached.
Mm-hmm.
It's being transmitted orally.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as time goes by, the gospel writers bring together their gospels and write them. And then, after those begin to circulate, the very term gospel goes from... It takes on additional meaning.
Additional meaning is a good way to say it.
It'll now mean a writing
right.
about Jesus Christ.
Jesus as a character. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
When we come back from this break, we're going to continue this conversation on the Lost Gospels. Dr. Jeffrey Kloa is our guest. Stay tuned.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Over 80 years ago, in a small attic room in South St. Louis, an announcer provided a brief message from God's Word. With this message, KFUO Radio began spreading the gospel, bringing words of hope, grace, and salvation to believer and unbeliever. KFUO was blessed with founders who believed in finding new and innovative ways to reach people with Christ's love. Today, KFUO Radio continues the tradition of innovation its founders sought in 1924. If you also believe in this mission, please consider becoming a member of the AM 850 Founders Club. For an annual investment of $850 or about $70 a month, you will receive a day sponsorship and invitation to a Founders Club dinner on September 23rd. Please call me, Jeff Pregmire, at 314-505-7867 and say, I want to be a founder.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. As Congress reconvenes today, lawmakers will find a stack of pro-family bills waiting for their attention. The issues range from human cloning to fetal pain. With an election just around the corner and liberals dragging their feet, conservative lawmakers will have to work hard to pass any pro-family legislation this session. Kim Troby reports.
There's always a lot of work to be done on Capitol Hill, but the bottleneck of pro-life legislation seems heavier than ever. Bills before Congress include the Unborn Child Pain Awareness Act, the Human Cloning Prohibition Act, and the Child Custody Protection Act, to name a few. David Christensen is with the Family Research Council.
Frankly, a lot of folks on the other side of the aisle have been doing everything they can to prevent any of these bills from moving forward.
One example is the Child Custody Protection Act, which passed last session by both the House and Senate, but was prevented from going to conference by the Democratic leadership.
This is a very political decision on their part, and I say that primarily because many of the Democrat senators did vote for the bill.
Amanda Banks with Focus on the Family Action points out that liberals have been at home telling constituents that they voted in favor of this pro-family legislation.
And yet rely on their leadership to obstruct it from getting to the president, because they don't really want this to pass. They just want it to look like they supported it.
Since the GOP remains in power in the House and Senate, Banks is counting on them to get these stalled bills moving.
We need to continue to put pressure on the Republican leaders as well. They have to keep coming back to this again and again.
Legislation that enjoys the support of both chambers of Congress should breeze to passage, but she's not optimistic that they can get all of them through before the October break. For Family News in Focus, I'm Kim Troby.
Congress plans to adjourn October 6th, but that may change in order to allow members to go home to campaign before the election. In that case, there would be even less time to pass these bills. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Christian Family Night is back at the St. Louis Science Center. Last year, thousands of Christian families enjoyed this event. It's Tuesday, September 19th from 5 to 8:30 p.m. Tickets are $8 in advance, $6.50 for groups of 12 or more. Children under 2 are free. Ticket price includes parking and access to all the special features like the planetarium, IMAX, BJC Sportsworks, Discover Room, and special exhibits. Tickets will sell out fast. Visit ChristianFamilyNight.com for more information.
Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September is actually a CD and a booklet. It's titled Listening to Luther. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. The CD contains a recording of Luther's Small Catechism and hymns by Martin Luther. The booklet contains a history of the Small Catechism and several of Martin Luther's hymns, including the text. Listening to Luther, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Halfway through the program today, we're talking about the Lost Gospels. Dr. Jeffrey Kloa is our guest, Assistant Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. He's going to be leading a lay Bible Institute in October titled, Which Jesus? How Many Gospels Are There? And we're coming to you live right after a short vacation, Tuesday, September the 5th. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. In the first segment of our conversation, we covered quite a bit of ground talking about the so-called lost gospels are, in fact, simply just part of a whole cloud of extra-biblical writings from the first through third centuries and beyond that were never real serious contenders for inclusion by the church in the Christian canon of the New Testament. So what do we do with them today? I mean, they're obviously of scholarly interest. And we're talking about the Gospel of Judas being a genuine, bona fide, ancient document, but it doesn't reflect Christianity, rather an entirely different worldview, that of the Gnostic heresy. So we're going to continue talking with Dr. Jeffrey Kloa, and we want to hear from you as well. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Before the break, you were talking about how we went from gospel proclamation to gospel writing.
Mm-hmm.
Was it you or was it someone else who said that the whole genre of gospel is a literary genre invented by the early Christian church?
Oh, it was probably Jim. But, yeah, that's really the case. I mentioned this before. You have sort of hero literature in the Greco-Roman world, but nothing that really approximates the gospels in terms of a narrative, especially a narrative where somebody suffers. That just does not happen to the extent you find it in the gospels. The sort of sayings, deeds sort of a thing going on. It's really unique. Scholars for centuries have been trying to find parallels, and there really just are not precise parallels to this genre.
Won't go down the Greco-Roman world and find a gospel to any other Greco-Roman, that genre of history, where you've got infancy narratives and deeds and sayings and mighty works, and then a passion narrative at the end and great claims of divinity or anything.
Certainly.
What was the criteria that the early Christians used, consciously or unconsciously, when they were evaluating all these writings that were flying around?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, and I wish we had sort of a crystal ball. I think what we need to remember, and we talked a bit about this last time I was here as well, but what we need to remember is that these books did not just sort of fall out of nowhere. They weren't produced in a vacuum. They were all written for very specific purposes. So the Gospel of Luke, he says in the first four verses, he's writing to Theophilus in order that he might know the certainty concerning the things which he was taught. So Theophilus, and the verb there is katekel, to be catechized. So Theophilus had already been instructed in the faith, and he had some questions. So Luke writes a gospel, he says, in a sequential format, is the term he uses, so that Theophilus could be confirmed in his faith. So the message and the faith precedes the writing of the gospel. Now, if Theophilus had gotten Luke's gospel and it didn't match what he had been taught, what would Theophilus probably do? He probably wouldn't have kept it, or his people in his community would not have kept it. Paul says as much in the first chapter of Galatians. If somebody preaches a different gospel, get them out of here. So the gospels are not sort of happening from nowhere. They're written for Christian communities who would have recognized immediately whether or not their message is reliable, faithful, true, or not.
And it's not like I guess perhaps people have this idea that here's the Apostle John. And one day he says, I guess I better write some of this stuff down as kind of a personal memoir or something.
Yeah, as if it's a, sort of autobiography or after my career's over,
These are intentional writings for the church.
Well, yeah, exactly. John says these are written so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and by believing you may have life in his name. I mean, he tells us what it's for. Yeah.
All right, I want to come back to more of that when we come back from talking here with Matt in Florida. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Matt, thank you for waiting, and welcome to Issues Etc. Matt.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Okay, it's gone. It was a dial tone there for a second. Good afternoon, Dr. Kloa.
Hello.
I had to spend some time on this myself because, if you just kind of first blush look at, all of this, it does kind of look like, there was a lot going on back in those days, and maybe I better look at all of this. And I did kind of, but I realized that in my studies that I needed to get over the problem of circular reasoning, which is thrown up by atheist and liberal scholar alike. If you look at the New Testament, you don't find a whole lot. In fact, I can't find any references at all to a lot of these gospels that are supposed to be floating around the same time as the other gospels.
Right.
And, of course, someone says that's circular. That's one point. Could you kind of talk about how it's actually not circular? And the other aspect of that is how the New Testament writers are always shedding light on the Old Testament. And I noticed from reading a lot of these other Gospels and a lot of the other apocryphal writings that are wind up being Gnostic that they don't do that.
Right, yeah.
Okay, two good points, Matt. Thank you very much. First of all, respond, if you would, to that criticism of circular reasoning that, look, they're not genuine because we don't find Christians using them or referencing them, and the criticism would be, well, of course you don't, because winners write the history, and here we are right back around on circular reasoning.
Right. Well, I think the way around that, first, you do have actual some historical dates you can pin on. So no one disputes, for example, that Judas is a late second century document, or that the Gospel of Philip is a third century document. You know, so you have, you know, it's impossible for them to have been used at the same time that the canonical Gospels are being used. Just chronologically, it's impossible. But the second thing I think we need to keep in mind with all this is these other Gospels are not just sort of floating around in a vacuum either. Just as these other Gospels are used by Christians who already know the message, these other Gospels are being used by people who have a different message. And it's really impossible to imagine a scenario in which, say, the Gospel of Judas would be used alongside Mark. Completely different messages, completely different themes. You don't have references because they're simply not able to be used next to each other.
I guess you would have to assume, as many of those who have a high view of these other Gospels, you'd have to assume that in the early centuries of Christianity, the whole theology, the whole message was kind of in flux.
Right.
Chaos almost, well, until something emerged.
Here's the picture that you really have to assume if you want to say that these other Gospels are as legitimate. You have to assume a picture where the canonical Gospels were written in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, wherever you want to put them. You know, I'll just leave that open. And then John, you know, somewhere in the 90s. And then everybody sort of forgot about them. And then in the late second century, there was a sort of rekindling of the Jesus story, and then these other Gospels gained prominence, and these other ones were sitting around, and then it's sort of an open question at that point. But what you have to assume with that, again, is a sort of picture of history that you cannot find described anywhere in the ancient world or in these writings. These Gospels were written for the communities, copied by the communities, used by the communities consistently for 200, 300, 400 years down to our own day.
So not only the writing was intentional, which you mentioned a few minutes ago,
right,
but the transmission, the preservation, the circulation,
exactly,
was also intentional.
Intentional, yes.
It wasn't like I walked over to somebody's house and he's got a copy of Mark sitting on the coffee table and say, hey,
right,
can I borrow that? Well, sure, go
right
ahead.
And there was no borders where you can go and pick up three or four Gospels off the shelf and decide what you wanted to buy. It simply did not happen that way.
Okay. The other thing that Matt raised was the contrast between the canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, their high view of the Old Testament scriptures,
right,
and the low view that is apparent in the Gnostic Gospels or the other lost Gospels.
Right. That's an excellent point, and something that I think we really need to help people understand is the canonical Gospels simply assume the Old Testament framework. I mentioned this before. If God created the world, humanity fell into sin. God works through history to restore creation, ultimately through his son Jesus. That story is simply assumed in the canonical Gospels, and Jesus, as a first century Jewish person, quotes the Old Testament, works within that framework. It's all very consistent with what you would expect a first century Jewish person to say and think. On the other hand, these other Gospels have a completely different understanding of creation, as I said before. I mean, Gospel of Philip says creation was a mistake, and the one who made it was not imperishable. You know, no first century Jewish person could say that. So you have a whole different worldview, you know, these, again, emanations from the Pleroma and all these sorts of things, completely inconsistent with the Old Testament. Now, why I think this is significant is, and I hope we have a minute to talk about this, is because, you know, why are these getting play today? You know, these Nag-Hammadi texts were discovered in 1945. It wasn't until the last really 10 or 15 years that this became popular. And the reason is, I really think, because our culture is in such a state of flux regarding its own moorings. We're a culture who no longer believes that creation happened by a divine being. We're a society who no longer believes that there is a goal to creation, that there's an endpoint that's positive. We believe as a culture that we're simply accidents and that religion is personal choice that you make up yourself. And so what these other Gospels bring to the picture is, and this is how they're used, is that, well, you see, there were lots of versions of Jesus in the early church. There were lots of versions of Christianity. Let's not get so hung up on one particular version. If you like this one, that's fine. If you like that one, that's fine. But don't try to press yours on me. And I really think that's why these things get play today, if you will. because it sort of knocks Christianity down so that we can operate with our new worldviews.
What they really want is they those who are pushing this and those who find them so acceptable, these other gospels, they really want what they say of the first century Christianity to be true today. They want everything to be in flux and people
exactly.
to kind of choose from the grab
exactly.
bag of the different versions.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's certainly the case. The history looks like our society today.
Yeah. Okay. One other thing that I think is significant here is how the early church fathers dealt with the text of the New Testament, the Gospels in particular, but also talk
right.
about the New Testament in general. If I'm not mistaken, if we didn't have a single manuscript of the New Testament, if we've never dug one up, we could probably reconstruct the better part of it simply from quotations from the church fathers. So are they quoting the Gospel of Judas?
We could put it all together. Yeah, Judas is never quoted. There are some occasions where, again, you're not sure if he's saying it might have come from Thomas. You know, you got to keep in mind, again, in the ancient world, I think I might have mentioned this last time, only about 10 to 15% of the population could read. You didn't have a library full of books sitting on the shelf. When Tertullian is writing a homily or writing a discourse, he's generally quoting from memory. And so he's not like we do today, you know, control C from your Bible program and control V into your word processor. Depending on what kind of writing. Now, apologetic, you know, where he's kind of attacking opponents of Christianity, he's going to be a little more careful. But generally, they're not going to have a text in front of them as they're writing. It's from memory, and it's simply a part of their being, much more so than us today, where we don't really operate with memorizing texts and an oral environment like that.
Well, right. I mean, I've often pointed out in the course of Bible class and whatnot that, you know, the early church was reading the New Testament without chapter and verse.
Exactly.
Which means you had to memorize it.
Memorize the whole thing, yeah.
Because you couldn't, if you wanted to find a saying, you didn't have any guideposts
right.
in the text to find
exactly.
it.
That's exactly right. And the manuscripts themselves, there. I mean, there's nothing. It's simply words without even space divisions between the words. It's just massive letters on the page. And you almost have to know what you're reading before you even read it. Otherwise, you're going to be lost.
You pointed out in an earlier conversation that the way by which most people were exposed to the four Gospels was they may never have even laid eyes on the book,
exactly.
on the codices. They
exactly.
may have actually only heard it mm-hmm. as recited by a special class of clergy on the Lord's mm-hmm. Day. Tell us about
exactly.
that.
Well, yeah. Again, you know, because most people could not read, they would have heard the Gospel story, the lectionary readings in worship, heard them. The books were entrusted, it depends on the situation and the time frame, but the books were entrusted either to the readers or to the bishops, the pastors, and it was their responsibility to memorize and then read these to the congregation so that they can be interpreted and preached on for the people. Much like down into the Middle Ages, you know, we always talk, you know, Luther made the Bible available to people. Well, the fact is, it was expensive to make a book, and until the printing press, people just did not own books, pamphlets. And so even into the 15th, 16th century, people are hearing the message. They are not reading it. And, you know, I'm not sure that's always so bad. I know for myself in worship, I often prefer to not read as I hear the words being read from the lectern to try to grasp and get a little better handle on just the way the authors are presenting the material. We tend to pick up on a word here and a word there that we like, rather than having it kind of hit us, you know what I mean?
You mentioned earlier that the circumstances of their writing, their transmission, their circulation for the four Gospels, very different from the way we operate today.
Right.
Are the proponents of these Gospels today, Gospel of Judas, Gospel of Thomas, whoever they may be,
mm-hmm.
the ones who are pushing them, are they playing on the general ignorance of society about ancient history, and in particular, the profound ignorance of Christians about their own history?
Well, yeah, I mean, I hate to impute motives to people, but it is rather obvious that, you know, for example, with the Gospel of Judas, you never heard anybody tell you that Seth is described as the Christ in the Gospel of Judas. And you never heard anybody tell you that, well, in fact, the Gospel of Judas mocks Christians, those who believe that Jesus is the Son of God. It actually mocks Christians. You never heard that reported. Now you have to ask the question, why, again? You know, Gospel of Philip. It's a completely Gnostic perspective. And this is not what's reported. What's reported is, well, there's a different perspective on Jesus. And they never fill in the blank as to what that perspective is. It's simply raised in order to say something like, well, see, there are multiple Christianities. So let's not get too hung up on one particular version, and especially not the Orthodox version, because they won by, you know, asserting power or something, you know, typical postmodern move. That's why, you know, and I've done presentations like this in many places, so I simply encourage people to read them, read these things. Take a look and see where they're coming from, what types of issues they raise, if they're consistent with an Old Testament perspective, if Jesus might have thought anything even close to this. Just take a scan through them. They're available on the internet. You just go do a search for Gospel of Thomas. You'll find a translation on Google, and take a scan through. It's really rather enlightening to read the texts apart from the commentaries you hear on TV.
We're talking with Dr. Jeffrey Kloh about the Lost Gospels. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. You can email us here in the studio with a question or a comment. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Or you can call us in the last few minutes here with a question or a comment, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In 15 minutes, we're going to discuss instructing our children in the Christian faith with Deaconess Emily Carter and Christian parenting with Dr. Beverly Yonke. That's the last hour of Issues Etc. today. So Christians ought to read them. They ought to pick them up and read them, if only to get to understand what they really are.
Right. Yeah, I think for too long we have sort of been afraid of history in the Christian church. We sort of, you know, go from the book of Acts to Luther to, you know, the modern day or something like that and sort of leapfrog. But again, if we really believe that Jesus became flesh, that God acted in history, that God performed his mighty deeds beginning with, you know, Adam and Eve and Noah and Abraham and through the children of Israel, then I would indicate that God has always and will continue to act in history. And that what happened in the early church and the selection of the books, we don't need to be afraid of this. We don't need to be afraid that there was some sort of a conspiracy or something. But to recognize that God works in history, even to our own day. And to study that, to find comfort in that, and hope, because he never abandons his people. He continues to make his message known.
Kate writes this email from Japan. She says, you said that the Gnostic Gospels have completely different themes and references from the four Gospels so that they would never be used side by side. Nowadays, we have a number of so-called new revelations. They're used side by side with the four Gospels to put a different spin on them from what the Gospel writers originally intended. Is this a recent phenomenon, or do new revelations slash interpretations go as far back as these Gnostic Gospels? You don't see Benny Hinn writing a gospel,
yeah,
but he certainly does claim new revelations.
New revelations. I mean, the Apostle Paul had to deal with this in Corinth, where there were prophets saying all kinds of things. And, yeah, so it's been an issue throughout the church. And, in fact, it's exactly why we have a canon. If you want to know what authentic truth is, it must correspond to and be based on the apostolic witness, which is preserved for us in the New Testament, especially the Gospels and Paul. The very reason there is a canon is, in a sense, a reaction to this tendency throughout history to you know, want to find more out about God, to want to find God in ourselves. It's a continuous struggle in the church.
Dave is calling from St. Charles. Hi, Dave. Welcome to
Hi.
Issues, Etc.
Hi, I have a kind of a quick question. Since this is generally the Lost Gospels or so, I've run on to the Gospel of Gabriel. It's more of Jeff could lend the insights as to what that is, its origins, what it's about.
All right, thank you very much, Dave. He asks about the so-called Gospel of Gabriel. Know anything?
Sorry, I really don't have any idea. Gospel of Gabriel. Can you fill me in a little bit? Oh, he left the line.
Okay, then yeah. Was there one of the biggest arguments, you mentioned conspiracy a second ago, one of the biggest parts of the arguments made by the proponents of alternate Gospels is there was a point in the church's history where it expunged in some form or another all these alternate Gospels,
right,
raised up its own writings, canonized them, set them in stone, and said, here's the gold standard.
Right.
Was there ever such a point in history? And if so, how did it really go down?
Well, that's again sort of a, you know, I don't want to use the word dark period, but what we can say? I mean, was there ever a convention or a vote? You know, there's no document or no church council that would give any such indication. You know, the Da Vinci Code movie showed the Council of Nicaea in 325 voting. Well, that did not happen. The issue of Scripture was not discussed at all at that council. It was over and done with long before that.
So why did the church, why did they recognize a canon, a body that is, here are the boundaries of what is and what isn't?
Well, again, these writings corresponded to the apostolic preaching, and when you had no longer had apostles around any longer, where do you turn? How do you know what that person in front of you is saying to be true? You need a standard of some sort. So the Gospels function in that way.
This really is kind of an every Sunday morning issue,
right,
isn't it?
It's a weekly, daily issue of Christians using these texts, yes.
They become the standard by which we judge,
right,
the accuracy, the truth, the faithfulness of any preaching, writing, whatever it may be.
Exactly, right, and continue to do so to this day, right.
Dr. Jeffrey Kloa is Assistant Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. He's going to be leading a lay Bible Institute in October titled, Which Jesus? How many Gospels are there? So how many are there, finally?
Well, the Da Vinci Code says there's 80. Actually, if you add up all the lost Gospels, anything with the word gospel in it, you probably have about 30 to 35.
How many are there really, if we want to rightly understand both the word gospel and...
Well, if you want to talk about proclamation about the Messiah, Jesus, well, I guess you'd say there's four. if you want to say stories with Jesus in them, well, then you got your 30 or 35.
And that's the real big difference, folks, is there are lots of stories with Jesus in them as a character. The question is, which of them are the Gospels that actually proclaim the true Jesus as he lived, died, and lives again for us sinners? Pastor Jeffrey Kloa, thank you very much for being our guest here in Studio A.
Thank you.
There's the troubling aspect of this that I think probably will go away as quickly as the media's interest in these lost Gospels dies. And that is, Christians hear about them, they get nervous because they wonder whether or not they've been given the true story. You know, the earliest Christians were concerned about that too. In fact, that was really their basic concern when it came to these Gospels. Is this the true story? Is this actually what Jesus said and did, who Jesus really is? So there's no reason for us to be nervous here in the 21st century, because that question was already answered long ago by Christians, perhaps far more concerned as to whether or not what they were hearing preached went hand in hand with what those who saw Jesus do all these things recorded. The four Gospels as we have them are not the product of some sort of political war within Christianity where the winners wrote the history and the winners wrote the New Testament. No, they are simply the product of a church attempting Sunday by Sunday to be faithful to the message that the apostles preached, and the apostles being faithful because this is what they witnessed. The four Gospels are that witness. When Jesus says to his disciples at the end of almost every one of the Gospels that they will be witnesses of what he said and did and promised, witnesses to his death and his resurrection for a sinful world, it's part of what he was talking about. The faithful witness of those apostles, their witness continues here in these Gospels as we have them, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And you know, the amazing thing is you don't have to go back to the first century to hear the apostles preach to you. It's right there in the New Testament. That's what the early church understood, and that's what they also understood was missing from the so-called lost Gospels. When we come back from this break, we've got hour three of Issues Etc. ahead. We'll talk with Deaconess Emily Carter about instructing our children in the Christian faith, and we'll talk with Dr. Beverly Yonke about Christian parenting. Stay tuned.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.